I'm very happy now to welcome portrait photographer Annie Leibovitz. Her exhibition, Annie Leibovitz Pilgrimage, opens tomorrow morning at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, and it runs through the 5th of May. It opened last year at the Smithsonian American Art Museum and is being shown across the country over a two-year period. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you.
So, for those who know your work as a portrait photographer, this exhibition will be very surprising because there's not a living person in it, although there are objects belonging to a lot of people whom we know. How did you start this project? Did you see it as a pilgrimage from the beginning?
Well, it started slowly. It wasn't something that I knew exactly that I was going to do. I mean, Susan Sontag and I had talked about doing a book of places that we wanted to travel to. It was an excuse to travel to really interesting places, the pyramids. Susan died, and I was thinking about my next project, and I, strangely enough, I was at my cousin's son's bar mitzvah in Amherst, and my family is really interested in history, and my sister said, let's go over to the Emily Dickinson house, the homestead, and we went over and walked through Emily Dickinson's house, and then we went to her brother Austin's house, which is right next door. And the house hadn't been touched at all since the Dickinsons had died. And it was like the first time I'd ever had a sense of what it was like to walk into a Victorian house. I had no idea it was so dark. The wallpaper was sort of rotting off. I mean, the curators of the buildings didn't really quite know what they should do, you know, with the house. They didn't, you know, what to restore, what not to restore. But you realize you were walking into it the way it was in its day. And it was so dark and so interesting. There was no light in the house. I had a little small digital camera with me, and I just started taking pictures, just kind of abandonedly. And I was impressed, with no light in the house, how the digital camera could record the rooms almost the way your eye was seeing it. You know, digital is really fast. It's a fascinating moment for photography, technically, and so the whole project is actually done in digital. But it was seeing those rooms, sort of not lit up and sort of with their natural light, that sort of interested me. And also, I was drawn in to taking the pictures. When I work on assignment, you know, I usually have to bring a picture back, you know, and there's a lot of pressure, and you know, it's sort of taking photographs on demand, and
right.
this whole project is sort of going out and being seduced into a photograph in the way I started off, you know, to take a picture when you feel like you want to take a picture. So Emily Dickinson led to, in the book you'll see, the cover of the book actually is Niagara Falls, and I that summer did a trip with my children to Niagara Falls, and my children actually showed me that photograph. They stood by the edge of the falls. They were mesmerized, and I walked over, stood behind them, looked at what they were looking at, and took the picture right over their heads. So that cover photograph is really just, for all intents and purposes, a snapshot right over, you know, taken over my children's heads. So between those two moments, between the Dickinson House and Niagara Falls, when I went back to work that fall, I started thinking about going to places that interest me and taking photographs when I felt moved to taking photographs. I was getting an award at the National Photography Society in England, and I went to England, and I went to Virginia Woolf's writing studio, Darwin's house, Sigmund Freud's house, and I think at the end of that trip, I realized I was on to something. And I sat down and made a list of 12 places I wanted to go to. And, of course, one of them, you know, was here in Santa Fe, the O'Keeffe houses, you know, Ghost Ranch and Abiquiu.
I mean, it's very interesting. What you're saying is what I felt when I was reading the book. It felt like part of the pilgrimage was letting yourself be guided. And, you know, you write about Ansel Adams and how Ansel Adams visualizes photographs. And it felt like these were photographs that were almost coming to you, or that you were kind of an interaction with this journey.
That's all correct. I mean, that's all. It's a mishmash. I mean, it doesn't make too much sense. You have Graceland, you know, Elvis Presley mixed in with Annie Oakley and Monticello, and honestly, you could do this forever, this project. It's just, and you know, we do as people, we continually, you know, feed ourselves and learn. You know, what on my original list was the Lincoln Memorial. I didn't know why I wrote down the Lincoln Memorial. But the Lincoln Memorial led to Marian Anderson, led to Eleanor Roosevelt. Lincoln was an amazing, Lincoln all by himself was an amazing journey. I don't know, if you get out into this country, such a great country. I took the Heritage Trail. I went to Lincoln's birthplace in Kentucky and then traveled on through Indiana to his boyhood home and then ended up in Springfield at the Lincoln Museum there. And then felt myself compelled to go to Gettysburg. I don't know, I was definitely searching for something. Searching, you know, I think I've already said that the premise was to be moved. And, you know, I doing the magazine work that I do when I was young, and I started in it, you know, imagine working at Rolling Stone for you know, over 13 years, and then Vanity Fair, you know, it seems extremely exciting and glamorous, but it takes its toll. There are a lot of demands, and I think it just felt great to go out and take a set of notes. This is the other thing that's really important to realize. These aren't really photographs. It's note-taking. It really is the peripheral vision that I have when I go do a portrait. You know, like, you know, these are things that, you know, a photographer never stops seeing. You're seeing all the time. I see photographs all the time. It's like, it just depends on whether or not you pick up the camera and take the picture. You don't stop seeing. You don't stop mentally taking pictures. I'm always framing in my head. You know, it's a very strange, it's not strange at all. It's what I've been doing all my life. I'm just used to, you know, I'm looking at you sitting there and your arms on the back of your chair. You know, I framed you. And whether or not I pick up the camera or not, that's another thing. So this is a series of photographs that have a sense of sentiment and sort of coming to terms with, you know, looking and people that I've always sort of been interested in and realized I thought I knew something about them and didn't know anything about them at all. You know, I think that was really true with George O'Keefe. You know, we think we know who George O'Keefe is and we don't. I mean, I didn't, you know. I mean, you have a sense growing up with a name like George O'Keefe that you think, you know, again, you think you understand or you know, and then you walk into her studio in Abiquiú and, you know, just, I don't know, just reduced to tears. I mean, it's just so, I mean, I didn't even take a picture. I tried to take a picture of that studio. It's almost like trying to photograph a winter storm or something or a, you know, some great landscape. I ended up, you know, looking at the details for O'Keefe. I couldn't really, I left the room alone. I couldn't really bring myself to try to photograph it because it seemed like underestimating what was really there, you know.
There's a nice quote in the book when you talk about O'Keefe and you say, I've seen some ways I wish I could live, and Georgia O'Keefe sets the bar. And you know what's important to her by looking, you know, what is so simple and then what is so grand when you are in her studio.
I mean, she built that life for herself, and I think that's important to realize. She understood work. She understood working every day and her art. You know, I'm not qualified to really speak about George O'Keefe. I'm probably not qualified to speak about any of the people who are in the book. And it is a very kind of, you know, I tried in the book. In fact, I asked Sharon Delano if she would help me because I thought this couldn't just be a set of pictures. There had to be some history. It'd be nice if anyone was looking through the book that they understood sort of what I was taking in and some of the history. And I asked Sharon Delano to supplement some of my thoughts with some history. So there is, it's really a combination between Sharon Delano and myself, my editor. But no, I think what I was saying is it was such a simple life that she led. You know, she would get up and work. And I think what's wonderful is she was a great cook and she had a garden.
Right.
And I love that she said that she didn't really start eating right till she was 50, you know, and Adele Davis was one of her good friends. I was just attracted to the simplicity of the life that she built for herself. You know, I think we have tendencies to overdo everything if one has the chance. And I just think, you know, you want to get back to simplicity. I mean, I looked at Walden Pond and Thoreau, and, you know, I was very impressed. One of my favorite objects in the book is the Thoreau bed, which what did I know? I mean, first of all, I went to Walden Pond. I thought I was just going to photograph Walden Pond. You can't photograph Walden Pond. It's almost like walking into O'Keefe's studio in Abiquiu, but the Walden Pond, it's just an idea. It's not really a pond. There are books and books and books and books of Walden Pond in spring, summer, winter, fall, but it's not that. It's a sweet little pond, but it's more of an idea, just going out into the woods. It's not that pond per se. It's actually quite wonderful when you go there today. It's used. It's a big swimming pond. It always was. But that object, that bed, it was what I loved about it. Is I thought, you know, I don't know if you thought this, but I didn't know much about Thoreau, but I thought, oh, he probably slept on the ground, or he slept on a bed of nails, or something. And here was this very sophisticated Chinese. It looked like an insert to a Chinese sofa bed that he just added some legs to, and it was used as his bed in the small house at Walden. So it underlines how sophisticated he was, and he walked to town every day, and he saw people every day. He wasn't so isolated.
I think the thing that really got to me about this, and some of the images really made me choke up, and some of the stories as well. I mean, seeing the first draft of the Gettysburg Address, one can go see that, but somehow seeing it written there in Lincoln's handwriting, and then, you know, reading the story about Marian Anderson not being allowed by the Daughters of the American Revolution to sing in Constitution Hall because she was African American. And then she sings in front of the Lincoln Memorial, and I looked it up on YouTube, and there she is singing, and you cry.
Don't get me crying. I mean, I cry pretty easily, but no, I'm just tearing up to hear you talk about Marian Anderson, because when I found that dress, and actually I did end up finding photographs of her in the dress that were taken by Philippe Halsman for Time magazine. But you know, before she really managed to make a living at what she was doing, she made her own clothes. So when you look at the dress, you see this dress that we found just in a box, you know, in a closet off to the side when I went looking, as you say, for Marian Anderson. We pulled this gold dress out, and the most of the material is very light. It's kind of a light, it's hard to describe. But the insert of the red, which is to me almost like a big scar going through the dress, is this heavy, 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 very heavy material that had to drag the dress down. I mean, so, and then you see she sweated in the dress. I mean, you could see that it almost, to me, it's almost like the Lincoln gloves. I mean, you could see that this was on her body. And I found it very compelling. I mean, I found it very moving.
And I think that, first of all, going through this book, and I've just seen the exhibition, but I've spent a lot of time reading the book and looking at the images, and it seems like a lot of contemplations are made available to the viewer, and one of them is what gets saved and what goes away. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you talk about making friendships with these curators whose life is devoted to saving and preserving things. But, of course, most stuff gets washed away with time, and it should.
Goes away. Yeah.
And here are some things, and some things are so present, and these inanimate objects feel very alive. And then you go to Martha Graham's storage area, and everything is in boxes, and it's like the dance is so gone.
It's gone, yeah. There are layers and layers and layers and layers in this book. And, you know, you couldn't begin to write or talk about everything that's going on. I went searching. I was always enamored of Barbara Morgan's relationship with Martha Graham. They did these extraordinary photographs together. Anytime Martha Graham completed building a dance, she would call Barbara Morgan up, and Barbara would come, and Martha would stage the dance for her. And she would take these extraordinary photographs. One of those photographs is called Letter to the World, which is actually based on an Emily Dickinson poem. And it's a very famous photograph of Martha Graham kicking up her leg and the dress the dress moves with it. And you look at the material in the clothing at the time. It was a lot. It was wool. I mean, it was. They didn't have they didn't have latex, or they didn't have any rubber or elasticity in the costumes in those days. And so therefore, I think it was really wool. She's lifting up her leg, and this extraordinary dress is really part of the dance, as far as I'm concerned. I wondered if any of the clothing, I think maybe after doing Marian Anderson, I started to think about a way to sort of get into Martha Graham since she was gone, was to look for her costumes. That is a whole, again, a whole, we need another 3 days to discuss this, but Martha Graham, once in dance, once the choreographer is gone, it's pretty much gone.
Right.
And of course, that's the beauty of the art, is that it's in the air. It's not something you can save. You can't film it. You can't photograph it. Dance is in the air. It's just not impossible to, I mean, I can do portraits, but you can't really, there's no really great dance film or photography. Doesn't really.
It's not like a painting that's there on the wall forever.
Right. And that's the art of it, that's what's beautiful about it. It's there and it's gone. Well, can you imagine trying to hold on to Martha Graham? I mean, once she died, it sort of, went away. I was in my lifetime able to see some of her company when she was still alive, and everything was extremely, very, very rigid and very, very strong. And once she left, things started to sort of corrode. The company wasn't quite, it didn't have the same look. But what you should know is, yes, of course, walking into that storage room in Yonkers, I realized that was the picture, because that was what was left, is you can't hold on to that ethereal flight.
No.
It's a worse story than that. They actually, the Martha Graham Dance Company actually took over Merce Cunningham's old studio in Westbeth. I was so happy for them, because it's an extraordinary space. And they apparently moved all of this to the basement of Westbeth. And then Hurricane Sandy hit. And I heard that everything was destroyed.
Good heavens.
All the Noguchi.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow.
But you know what? Taken away in a hurricane, that's not so bad. If you think about it, the art of it,
Well.
But listen, what I want to say is you're absolutely right. About halfway through this book, I realized it's like sand. It will go away. We're all, it's all going to go away. And to see us trying to hold on to these things, these objects, it's very sweet. It's very kind of tender. But how much will really last is, it will probably have to be the stories that we pass on to our children, like the Bible and any other stories that get passed on. I think that's probably it will probably be the stories that survive.
Right. And at the same time, I mean, you look at these boxes and you think about the Martha Graham performance that you saw when she was alive, and then the performances that happened after she was alive that were really different and feel kind of dated once she's gone. And at the same time, and this is true, I guess this is what I really liked about the book, is that it made me think about all the cultural patterns that do survive.
Mm-hmm.
She probably changed the way we move, even though we don't know it. Emily Dickinson changed the way we think. These patterns of racism that go on and on and on are still with us. And you spent a lot of time in the 19th century, and it's still so present.
I didn't really realize that's what I was doing in some strange way. I began to realize, that's, I was happy to photograph the Farnsworth house because I realized it had broken into the 20th century, it was kind of a way of leaving the book. But then there are these timeless ideas like Smithson's Spiral Jetty, which
right.
I think are, I always knew it was going to be the ending in the book because it's a beginning, it's like, or never ending.
That pattern. The spiral.
Right.
We're talking to photographer Annie Leibovitz. Now, the book, the way it's put together, and again, I'm so focused on the book because I've spent so much time with it, and the exhibition, Pilgrimage, is at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum and will be here for the next several months. But one of the things that's sort of interesting about the book is you are reading along about Georgia O'Keeffe, but seeing pictures of Elvis's turntable.
Oh.
And so the narrative of the picture and the narrative of the book don't really go together, but that creates an effect.
I don't think we were trying that so you know, so much. What I thought is, as I was building the book, and I knew that there was a certain deadline to get the book done. And when you build text and you build pictures at the same time, you have a choice. You can either put the text with the pictures or you can separate it. And I decided to make the text a river, and that it was just a continual ongoing river. I didn't explain that very well or at all. You know, I sort of left it to the viewer. And it is probably disconcerting a little bit to be reading the text through as you see the pictures. One of the things I did do was I put a very healthy caption by each photograph so that you could, on some level, not read the text and just read the captions, and you would have a book in your head. The captions are very... Sometimes the captions are better than the text in the book. I mean, that was my idea, because sometimes I don't read. I don't read. I just look at pictures, and I know how I look at a book, and I wanted the ability for someone to just, you know, not have to read the book if they didn't want to. But if they wanted to read the book, they could. It's a lot to read.
It is a lot to read, but I don't know. I like to read, but I enjoyed it. Because, I mean, first of all, I mean, it's so much about being American. Even though you got Freud and Darwin and Virginia Woolf, they affected us. They affected our culture so much too. And I wondered, I mean, after this was all done, it's such a departure from your portrait work. And in some ways, I mean, it blurs the line between animate and inanimate objects. You know, you think some of these things have their ghosts in them of the people who use them. But how has it affected what you've done since then?
Well, you know, I would be asked, you know, as we've been showing the show, well, are you giving up your portrait work or whatever? I mean, that's why I have to sort of emphasize these are notes for taking portraits, number one. And number two, it flows right into my portrait work. I mean, last night at my lecture, I showed some portraits, you know, that I did, you know, right after completing this project. And you can feel pilgrimage, you know, you can feel the work that was done on pilgrimage, which is, you know, sort of reminding yourself of the small details that are off to the left and the right of a portrait. It's more reinforced in, you know, in my portraits. I've always been an environmental portraitist. I've always been interested in placing someone somewhere, you know, and if I had my choice, I'd always start in their home. I mean, I've always been interested in what chair they sit in, right. You know, it always seems strange to me to displace someone if you're taking their picture. I mean, they should be attached to something that so you can see them. You can see them clearly. One of my favorite photo essays of O'Keeffe is really John Lowengard's pictures of her. And they, again, one of the fun parts about this project was going back and doing research and looking through that book of O'Keeffe by John Lowengard. It was just so touching and so beautiful, him following her as she walked the hills. Those pictures are haunting in my head. I see her walking those hills. You know, she walked those hills every day. And that's where she found her rattlesnakes. You know, so that to me is like a perfect kind of portrait, you know, is to spend that kind of moment or time with someone in their home, in their environment.
Annie Leibovitz, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you. It was great. I enjoyed it.
The exhibition Annie Leibovitz Pilgrimage opens tomorrow morning at 10 at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, and it runs through the 5th of May. And I'd like now to welcome to the program Joe Traugott. He is curator of 20th century art at the New Mexico Museum of Art. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
So it's great fun to have you in the cafe.
This is a treat.
Well, it is a treat, and I was over there at the George O'Keeffe Museum yesterday, so I recorded that interview that our listeners just heard, and now here we are in the cafe talking about the exhibitions, two exhibitions that are in the New Mexico Museum of Art right now. One is called It's About Time, 14,000 Years of Art in New Mexico. Ladies and gentlemen, you heard that number right. And another show called Back in the Saddle. So let's talk about, 14,000 years, I mean, certainly it's only been New Mexico per se for 100 years. Is that right?
That's right.
But what do you have, what objects and how are they art, these objects that go back all these millennia?
Well, the New Mexico Museum of Art is the state art museum. And our mission is really to present the art of New Mexico which really begins 14,000 years ago with the first New Mexicans, the Paleo-Indians, who we know as the makers of Clovis points and Folsom points. And these are stone tools, but they're also works of art. And the exhibition continues through High Pueblo periods, through Spanish colonial, American colonial, and then to statehood. And the exhibition ends with contemporary art. It's a fast history of New Mexico told through the art that we have made.
So those early spear points, make the case of why those are art.
Well, they're art for two reasons. From the maker's point of view, they incorporated a whole series of high technology chipping processes that really went beyond what was minimally necessary to make a spear point. And so they aestheticized these objects when they made them. From our own 21st century perspective, 70 years ago, when these objects were found in the context of the bones of the animals they hunted, they became art for us that represents the totality of what Paleo-Indian people did. The knowledge that they had of the environment, their ability to exist with minimal technology, that gives us a kind of conceptual view of Paleo-Indians, which is really an artistic view as well.
And so you then go in the exhibition to some very early Pueblo pots, and there's a beautiful video of how the designs on these pots are constructed. It ends up being sort of an Escher-like positive-negative space kind of thing that I'd never really thought about looking at these.
Well, one of the things that we have done is to show the aesthetics of Pueblo pottery, ancestral Pueblo pottery, from roughly 900 to 1350. This material, if you look closely, incorporated designs and the absence of designs that were equal, and they flipped. And so these flipped equal designs we're calling isomers, iso-equal, mer shape, equal shapes. But what's so interesting about these designs is when you look at them, they also flip back and forth, and the background becomes the foreground becomes the background. And the animation that we have shows how this flipping takes place and demonstrates very clearly that these two parts, the positive and the negative, in fact, are equal.
Which probably has a tremendous amount to say about differences in visual thinking and in cultural thinking, and what we, you and I, might think of as foreground and background really aren't foreground and background.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's so interesting is that we as literate people are used to seeing black shapes, letters, on clear backgrounds on paper, and it's very difficult for us to see that kind of flipping and reversal because we have trained ourselves for so many years to see just the opposite.
Right.
But if you look at these Pueblo objects and allow your eyes to unfocus and slightly stare at the material, all of a sudden the reversal takes place and the background does become the foreground.
And if you think about a landscape, there is, in not in a painting, yes, but in real life, especially if you're a hunter, there is no background.
Right.
It's all okay. So we're talking about the exhibition. It's about time, 14,000 years of art in New Mexico. And so, I mean, you take us through the Spanish conquest and the mixing of the Spanish and Pueblo styles, which, if this exhibition is an example, it's really hard to say where one begins and the other leaves off.
I think that's true. And what's so important, I think, about the exhibition is the way that it shows the fusions that have taken place across cultural divides between cultures over many, many millennia. And so that's one of the important points that this exhibition makes. It's an exhibition that was organized and supported by the New Mexico Humanities Council, in large part because, as a centennial project, it covered the whole of New Mexico art and not simply the last few years of our tradition.
So let's talk about, in order to talk about everything, we're going to have to kind of skip a few things. But there are a lot of painters who were here in New Mexico who, first of all, I didn't even know were here, and who painted, famous American and European painters who did work here that wasn't the way we usually think about their work, like the modernist Stuart Davis, for example, or even some of the Bauman paintings, are really surprising. And I was looking at this show yesterday and thinking, this is really one of the beautiful benefits that we have and that you as a curator have, to show us these treasures that never make it to New York or places like that.
Well, that's true. New York has a vision of art that is New York-centric. And New Mexico really has an incredible art tradition that is independent of that as well. When Stuart Davis came, he was used to painting in a studio, and he found the incredible light, the space, etc., to be very difficult. And so he responded in 1923 by abandoning color in his painting. And that's something that we find difficult to understand.
Really?
But he made these monochrome black to and gray and white paintings that allowed him to reconstruct the landscape as a painting and not simply copy what he was looking at. And similarly, Gustav Bauman, who we think of as a printmaker known for his color woodcuts, was also a painter. And he, in his paintings, began to abandon that ultra-simplicity that he found in the woodcuts and began to incorporate very decorative elements. And so his paintings look quite different from the woodcuts that we now identify as his mature style.
This exhibition, and I think a lot of things that have happened over the last couple of years, have been about the centennial. Now it's 101 years since New Mexico became a state. And there's that very famous painting by Gerald Cassidy, which is kind of an iconic painting in New Mexico and one of the premier objects in the museum. Tell us about that one.
Well, Cui Bono is a painting that so many people know and identify with the museum. The title, Cui Bono, is Latin for who benefits. And the painting was made in 1911, a year before statehood. And so the painting reflects the uncertainty that New Mexicans had over the political outcome of statehood. So will the Pueblos disappear? Who will become wealthy? How will we coexist as part of the United States in a formal sense? And so these kinds of uncertainties are wrapped up in this very iconic painting. And as an art historian and a curator, we continue to rethink that question of who benefits from the art of New Mexico in all of the projects that we do. And it's very important for us to aim our work at the general public. And one way that we're doing that with 14,000 years of New Mexico art is to take it on the road. And so we have a road version of the exhibition. It's a panelized photographic show called Art Across New Mexico.
So it's pictures of the... you're not shipping the paintings, you're shipping pictures of the paintings.
Right, with the narratives that make it clear. And so this exhibition opens this week in Lee County at the Lovington, New Mexico, the Lee County Museum, and then it moves to Portales, to Tucumcari, to Farmington, Gallup, Clayton, Raton, Silver City, Las Cruces, and Las Vegas. So 11 venues throughout the state. So we're making this statewide project accessible to the entire state.
That is awesome. Now, one of the things you were talking about in the Gerald Cassidy painting, this question of what will happen to this state, and I always find it amazing, like when you think about, okay, that was 100 years ago, and nobody could probably imagine what this state was like 100 years later, and we cannot even begin to imagine what the state will be like 100 years from now.
That is so true.
Some of us shudder to think.
That is so true.
But one of the things that happened, and this in the years leading up to statehood, was this whole question of, is Native American culture going to disappear? And a lot of anthropologists and painters really took on this issue in trying to, if not preserve them, at least keep documents of them.
Well, that's one of the ironies of New Mexico culture, is that outsiders are always trying to interpret what we do here in the state. And we're always a little leery of that. But these painters came with their own set of values and somehow fused them with the kind of imagery that they found here. Sometimes the work became a little stereotyped and can be thought of as condescending, but that was not their goal. And similarly, we live in a very complex intercultural world, and New Mexico has maintained that sense of interculturality, and that's one of the wonders of New Mexico and why it's so important for us to support the art and the culture that we have here.
I was thinking, when looking at those sort of, there's a whole section of the romanticizing of Pueblo people and all of that, and I thought, you know, what's life going to be like in 2113, and probably the only people who are going to be left is the Pueblos.
Well, that could be.
And I mean, that culture will survive.
And clearly, 100 years from now, people will be making romantic comments about the counterculture of the 1960s and 70s, you know. We become so blasé about what we are so familiar with in New Mexico. The perfect example of that is that in 1945, New Mexico really did change the world when the atomic bomb was invented here. It has both its positive and negative aspects. We're all happy to go down and have a CAT scan made, but we're not maybe so happy about the military impact of atomic energy. But New Mexico has changed the world, and we have a 13.5-foot wide blow up of the original Trinity site nuclear explosion from July 16, 1945. And it's really an incredible experience to become really part of that explosion and see ourselves as part of that changing world.
Well, and as you pointed out, when I saw you in the museum yesterday, the exhibition kind of spans spear points to nuclear tests.
Yes. And what's, I think, important about that is that New Mexico is the only place in the world where our history of technological invention goes from stone tools, from spear points, to the invention of the atomic bomb. And within the exhibition, we have other works that were not made to be works of art, but now become works of art in the context of the museum. And a good example of that is one of Robert Goddard's experimental rocket motors that now looks like a primitive sculpture.
It does. It's very strange.
It's a wonderful piece. And then, in a more contemporary sense, I have James Parker's modern motorcycle that doesn't have a traditional front end. It doesn't have the bicycle twin forks that we all know. It has a front end that is held, the wheel is held from one side and has a whole series of patents associated with it. And so this sense of invention and technological change is clearly a contemporary part of the museum as well.
We're talking to Joe Traugott about the exhibition It's About Time, 14,000 Years of Art in New Mexico, which runs until January of next year. And, I mean, so much more in it than we've even talked about. For example, Jerry West, our own wonderful painter Jerry West, has a tremendous painting of a Japanese internment camp. And what I didn't know was that his father and uncle were guards at this camp.
And so he, as a young boy, would go visit his father and uncle. And so now, as a senior artist in the community, he is revisiting some of those memories. And the painting is really a very powerful one, showing the detention camp, really the prison that was here in downtown Santa Fe.
So let's talk about the other show that is up. It's a smaller show. And very terrific what, a couple of rooms called Back in the Saddle. Now, this is a show of horses, and it's a collaboration with the Institute of American Indian Arts Museum. Or what is it called now? SWIA.
It's the exhibition.
Did it change its name? Go ahead.
The exhibition, Back in the Saddle, was co-curated by John Torres Nez, who is the executive director of SWIA, who puts on Indian Market every August. And the exhibition shows images of horses and horse-related material from Native American, from Hispanic, and European American artists. And both of us have written the commentary that goes along with these pieces. And the commentary really bridges our two points of view. So John brings a very political and culturally a clear perspective. And I bring a sort of social commentary as well as art historical perspective to these images.
I like that. I have to say, two different curators commenting on the same things. It takes away that sort of authoritative voice. It's just multiple voices, and then the viewer can have their own opinion.
Oh, always the case. I think it's very important for museum curators to express a point of view, but to leave open that sense of what things really do mean to the individual. And without having some narrative about this material and some point of view that expresses the clarity that there are so many perspectives about art in New Mexico, that we can confuse our tourist friends who come looking, expecting, well, maybe representational pictures of Native people, and finding everything from Agnes Martin to stone tools.
Right. Now, in the exhibition about horses, Back in the Saddle, we have a lot of, I mean, I think what happens is in the Southwest and in New Mexico, horse art can quickly go into romanticism and tourist art and things like that. And so that is part of the perspective that you have to deal with when you're curating a horse show.
Well, that's always the case with any kind of New Mexico subject. But John and I like to horse around, so we have, I think, brought that perspective to this exhibition as well.
Tell us about some of the pieces in it. What are some of your favorites?
Well, one of my true favorites is the earliest piece in the exhibition, which is a photograph by George Wharton James from 1897. And it shows two European American men explaining the function of a camera to two Navajo men who are standing in front of a horse. And so this is a wonderful photograph that explains the complex attitudes that we have had about photography and the fears that many Native peoples have of photography and the camera, as well as our own Western view that cameras are naive and harmless instruments. It really points to the complexity of life in New Mexico and that combination of the simplicity of horse-drawn transportation as well as the high technology of a box camera at the end of the 19th century.
Right, right. And there is, of course, reference to Remington without Remington actually being there.
Well, we have a wonderful Fritz Scholder, very expressive lithograph, brightly colored, powerful, simplistic, abstract shapes that parody that work, but transform what was this iconic Western image into a Native image. And I think that's one of the powers of New Mexico art, is our ability to appropriate ideas across cultural divides and transform them and make them our own, from our own perspectives.
One of the things that in the entrance to the 14,000 Years of Art in New Mexico show, you have a kind of introductory section, which is basically a kind of like, what is art? What's that all about?
Well, we have a lot of people who come from very different cultural backgrounds who come to the museum. We have people from Asia. We have people from Europe. And people have different attitudes about what art is. And our perspective is a very broad one. And so we define art as an aestheticized object that reflects the maker's worldview. That's very simple, and it allows us to incorporate a whole lot of objects that other more traditional museums might not include in an exhibition like this. At the same time, most people think that an art object is something that an artist makes. In our exhibition, you, the viewer, becomes an artist in many cases. And so when we have an object like a scintillator, which is a high-tech Geiger counter that looks, depending on your age, either like a Buck Rogers ray gun or a hairdryer.
Right.
In reality, it's a high-tech Geiger counter from the 1950s. But you, as the viewer, transform this mechanical object into an object, a work of art, that expresses the complexity of the post-World War II period, of the atomic age, of the Cold War. And so as an object, it becomes very symbolic of the complexity of life at the end of the 20th century.
Did that thing come from the black hole?
No, it didn't. It came from eBay.
You're kidding.
That's another black hole.
This is a little insight into where the New Mexico Museum is acquiring its objects. But one of the things that is really impressive is your permanent collection. And you can draw from that in all of these exhibitions that you do.
Yes. And we have sister institutions that are also state museums. So many of the objects have come from the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture, or they've come from the Museum of International Folk Art, or from the History Museum. We borrowed the stone tools from Eastern New Mexico University, where they have the world's premier Paleo-Indian site called Blackwater Draw. And so we are able to bring together the art of New Mexico from other institutions that have slightly different missions than we do as the State Art Museum.
When you do a show like this, do you get feedback from the public?
It's been wonderful. It has been wonderful. And one of the things that we've done differently in this exhibition is to turn our labels upside down. And so we start off not with who, what, where, and when, but rather, what is this object about? And really ask a question in that first few words that hooks our audience into having to read that label in order to really see the whole point that we are trying to make. And as a result, I've had really very surprisingly supportive response from our visitors.
Very interesting. Now, ladies and gentlemen, when he says we're turning our labels upside down, you don't have to stand on your head. It just...
I guess that's true.
It just means the information is at the bottom of about who the sort of who the painter is and when it was painted and things like that. And I think, again, I mean, for those of us who tend to be more verbal types, text types than visual, having that text accompaniment is so helpful. I just think wall texts in general, if they're well done, are incredibly important parts of the exhibition.
Well, it's difficult to write really good labels that really approach both a not-so-sophisticated art looker as well as an art professional.
Exactly. And yeah, you're writing for the 9-year-old school children, and you're writing for the art historians, and you're writing for the casual Sunday.
That's it.
Joe Traugott is curator of 20th century art and also 14,000 years ago art.
That's true.
At the New Mexico Museum of Art. The shows are It's About Time, 14,000 Years of Art in New Mexico, which is on display until January 5th of next year, and Back in the Saddle, which is on display until the 15th of September. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's been great.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can, I think, you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafemc. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. And we will see you tomorrow with the legislative update. And speaking of the arts, hasta la vista. Ciao.